trusted voice of truth and light.
God gave me a gift. I shovel well. I shovel very well.
And a rally point for those who've accepted the reality that they are not sheep.
We've got a blind date with destiny.
And it looks like she's ordered the lobster.
This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Well, hello there and welcome to the show. This is a program dedicated to persuading people like you and me to think as clearly and independently as possible. Seeing as we live in an age of misinformation, and I'm not talking about, you know, unregulated talk and free speech on the internet. I'm talking about official misinformation, official narratives, which we are supposed to believe or otherwise, I guess, be excommunicated from polite society. If you're the kind of person with the courage to embrace that excommunication and to take hope and find your ranks among the other wrong thinkers, welcome, brother. Welcome, sister. Come, pull up a chair. Let us revel in wrongthink and find courage and camaraderie, but more importantly, let's make the difference that we were born to make by seeking truth tirelessly. I want to start with what I know is on a lot of people's minds, and that is, of course, the shooting in Buffalo that's dominating the news cycle right now. And there's a lot of hay that is going to be made by politicians. This is a high-profile, heinous crime, ugly as they get, and so it's going to dominate the news cycle for some time, as long as there is some perceived political advantage. And as they tell you, what is to be done? Here's what we're facing. And it's going to look something like, I believe it's right-wing extremism. Essentially, there are some people already on Twitter coming out and saying, hey, you know, this is what happens. This is your average Republican out there acting out their systemic racist fantasies. I mean, that's pretty nice. We just condemned half the voting public, you know, by lumping them in with this kid who appears to have been really, sincerely off his rocker. But before you go buying into this narrative or that narrative, I just want to run a couple of different words past you and ask you to consider what all of these things have in common. You ready for this? Okay, the words are Operation Northwoods, MK Ultra, Operation Timber Sycamore, Ruby Ridge, the Tuskegee Study, Fast and Furious, the Manhattan Project, the Eugene L. Sanger experiments, Operation Paperclip, or President Coolidge poisoning alcohol purposely. What do those things all have in common? The answer is they are all real, they are all demonstrable, and yet people would tell you, well, you're crazy if you think the media and government would lie to us. That list, though, says otherwise. Of course they would. And of course they do. So I'm not trying to tell you this is the only way to think. I'm just saying be skeptical. It's okay to question what's going on. I'm going to take it one step further, though, here with the help of Glenn Greenwald. There's a very clear pattern that you see. Every high-profile crime seems to provide instant opportunity to blame your political opponents. And here is a great article from Glenn Greenwald about the demented and selective game of instantly blaming political opponents for mass shootings. And Glenn's point here is he says, look, all ideologies spawn psychopaths who kill innocents in its name. Yet only some are blamed for their violent adherence, and that's by opportunists cravenly exploiting corpses while they still lie on the ground. So as an example, he says, at a softball field in a Washington, D.C. suburb on June 14, 2017, a lone gunman used a rifle to indiscriminately spray bullets at members of the House GOP who had gathered for their usual Saturday morning practice for an upcoming charity game. The then-House Majority Whip, Representative Stephen Scalise, was shot in the hip while standing on second base and almost died, spending 6 weeks in the hospital and undergoing multiple surgeries. Four other people were shot, including two members of the Capitol Police who were part of Scalise's security detail, a GOP staffer, and a Tyson Foods lobbyist. Representative Mike Bishop of Michigan said he was hunting us at that point, speaking of the shooter who attempted to murder as many people as he could while standing with his rifle behind the dugout. Now, the shooter died after engaging the police in a shootout. He was James T. Hodgkinson, a 66-year-old hardcore Democrat who, less than 6 months into the Trump presidency, had sought to kill GOP lawmakers based on his belief that the Republicans were corrupt traitors, fascists, and Kremlin agents. Gee, I wonder where he got that idea. The writings he left behind permitted little doubt that he was driven to kill by the relentless messaging he heard from his favorite cable host, MSNBC's Rachel Maddow, and other virulently anti-Trump pundits about the evils of the GOP. Indeed, immediately after arriving at the softball field, he asked several witnesses whether the people gathered there were Republicans or Democrats. Now, a CNN examination of his life revealed that Hodgkinson's online presence was largely defined by his politics. In particular, his public Facebook posts date back to 2012 and are nearly all about his support for liberal politics. He was particularly passionate about tax hikes on the rich and universal health care. NBC News explained that when he got angry about politics, it was often directed against Republicans, and acknowledged that Hodgkinson said his favorite TV program was the Rachel Maddow Show on MSNBC. Indeed, his media diet was a nonstop barrage of vehement animosity toward Republicans. His favorite television shows were listed as Real Time with Bill Maher, The Rachel Maddow Show, Democracy Now!, and other left-leaning programs. On the Senate floor, Senator Bernie Sanders divulged that Hodgkinson was an ardent supporter of his and apparently had even volunteered for his campaign. A Sanders supporter told the Washington Post that he campaigned for Bernie Sanders with Hodgkinson in Iowa. Now, the mass shooter had a particular fondness for Maddow's nightly MSNBC show. In his many letters to the editor sent to the Belleville News Democrat, reported New York Magazine, he expressed support for President Obama and declared his love for the Rachel Maddow show. In one letter, he heralded Maddow's nightly program as one of my favorite TV shows. And while consuming this strident and increasingly rage-driven Trump-era anti-GOP media diet, Hodgkinson joined several anti-GOP Facebook groups, including Terminate the Republican Party, The Road to Hell is Paved with Republicans, and Join the Resistance Worldwide. Two of his consuming beliefs were that Trump-era Republicans were traitors to the United States and fascist white nationalists. In 2015, he posted a cartoon depicting Scalise, the man he came very close to murdering, as speaking at a gathering of the KKK. Now, once Trump was inaugurated in early 2017, the mass shooter's online messaging began increasingly mirroring the more extreme anti-Trump and anti-GOP voices that did not condemn just the GOP's ideology, but depicted them as grave threats to the Republic. In a March 22nd Facebook post, Hodgkinson wrote, "Trump is a traitor. Trump has destroyed our democracy. It's time to destroy Trump and company." In February, he posted, "Republicans are the Taliban of the USA." In one Facebook post just days before his shooting spree, Hodgkinson wrote, "I want to say, Mr. President, for being an a-hole, you are truly the biggest a-hole we've ever had in the Oval Office." As NBC News put it, Hodgkinson's Facebook postings portray him as stridently anti-Republican and anti-Trump. Now, despite the fact that Hodgkinson was a fanatical fan of Maddow, Democracy Now! Host Amy Goodman, and Sanders, that the ideas and ideology motivating his shooting spree perfectly matched and were likely shaped by liberals of that cohort, and that the enemies whom he sought to kill were also the enemies of Maddow and her liberal comrades, nobody rational or decent sought to blame the MSNBC host, the Vermont senator, or anyone else whose political views matched Hodgkinson's for the grotesque violence he unleashed. And the reason for that is clear and indisputable. As strident and extremist as she is, Maddow has never once encouraged any of her followers to engage in violence to advance her ideology. Nor has she even hinted that a mass murder of Republican traitors, fascists, and Kremlin agents about whom she rants on a nightly basis to millions of people is a just solution. Now, Glenn Greenwald says it would be madness to try to assign moral or political blame to them. If we were to create a framework in which prominent people were held responsible for any violence carried out in the name of an ideology they advocate, then nobody would be safe. Given that all ideologies have their misfits, psychopaths, unhinged personality types, and extremists. And thus there was little to no attempt to hold Maddow or Sanders responsible for the violent acts of one of their most loyal adherents. Now, he goes on to talk about a couple of other mass shootings and killings by self-described black nationalists over the last several years. We're going to touch on these when we come back after the break. But the point is, the ideas that motivated these black nationalists to murder multiple people, including police officers, was part of a core ideology commonly heard in mainstream media venues expressed by many, if not most, of the nation's most prominent liberals. However, depicting the police as a white supremacist force eager to kill black people, grievances against perceived white dominance, and anger over white supremacism endemic in America's system of governance from the country's founding. I mean, these are views you hear routinely on MSNBC, CNN, Democratic Party politicians, the New York Times, the New York Post. But nobody sought to blame them for these shooting sprees. So why is that changing now and Republicans being blamed?
This is the Brian Hyde Show. This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Hey, welcome back to the show. Quick shout out here to the Heather Turner team at Patriot Home Mortgage. These are the folks you want to talk to if you are trying to secure a mortgage, whether it be a home loan, a VA loan, a reverse mortgage, whatever it may be. The Heather Turner team at Patriot Home Mortgage is there to help you with the experience, the stability, and the clout to get the home you need, and to get the loan you need, rather, and without delay. Now, this is for my listeners in the Utah and Idaho region. If you are home shopping, or if you're going to be home shopping, talk to Heather. You can call her at 435-703-4522, or you can also stop by her office at 619 South Bluff Street in St. George, Utah. Her NMLS ID is 715386, and Patriot Home Mortgage is an equal housing opportunity lender. So I'm sharing with you this article from Glenn Greenwald about the demented and selective game of blaming one's political opponents whenever there is a high-profile crime, particularly a mass shooting or other, you know, heinous act like this. One of the things I love about Glenn Greenwald is he's not just shooting from the hip. He's giving you documented examples of different murders made in the name of, you know, this ideology or that ideology. But his point is, when these things were done by people on the political left, it was not common to see people immediately lining up to blame. Well, it's because, you know, it's because of my political opponents that they did what they did. He says, since 2017... there have been many more murders in the name of this anti-police, anti-white supremacist ideology of black nationalism. And he gives more examples. But again, he points out that you just don't see that same standard of, well, this is all about the Republicans, or, you know, that we're seeing right now in the wake of this shooting in Buffalo, New York. I mean, I know you wouldn't remember this because it went down the memory hole almost immediately after it came out, but do you remember hearing about a guy by the name of Frank James last month that went on a shooting spree in the New York City subway system? He didn't kill anybody, thankfully, but he injured dozens. And he had posted some really nauseatingly extremist ideology on social media linked to black identity extremism like Nation of Islam, Black Panthers, Black Liberation Army, BLM, and of course, a black nationalist cop killer, Micah Johnson. Now, most media outlets and liberal politicians correctly refused to assign blame to pundits and politicians who spew anti-police rhetoric or who insist the U.S. is a nation of white supremacy, which is the animating idea of many of these black nationalist murders. Yet in these cases, they go much further with their denialism. Many deny that this ideology even exists at all. Now, Glenn's point here is not to try to claim that there's no such thing as white supremacy either. But his point is simply this: it's impossible to find any ideology on any part of the political spectrum that hasn't spawned senseless violence, and mass murder by adherents. The suspected killer of Dutch maverick politician Pim Fortuyn had environmentalist propaganda and ammunition at his home, reported CBS News about the assassin Volkert Vandergraaf. Vandergraaf was apparently a passionate animal rights and environmental activist who admitted he killed the controversial right-wing leader because he considered him a danger to society. Now, Vandergraaf was particularly angry about what he believed was Fortuyn's anti-Muslim rhetoric. Some supporters had blamed Green Party leader Paul Rosenmuller for demonizing Fortuyn before he was gunned down in May, just before general elections. In other words, because the Green Party leader was highly critical of Fortuyn's ideology, some opportunistic Dutch politicians absurdly sought to blame him for Fortuyn's murder by Van der Graaf. That sound familiar? During the BLM and Antifa protests and riots of 2020, an Antifa supporter, Michael Reinhold, the leading suspect in the murder of a Trump supporter as he rode in a truck, was arrested. Let's try that again. As he rode in a truck, Reinhold himself was then killed by federal agents in what appeared to be a deliberate extrajudicial execution, though an investigation cleared them of wrongdoing, as typically happens when federal agents are involved. In 2016, the New York Times reported the heavily armed sniper who gunned down police officers in Dallas, leaving five of them dead, specifically set out to kill as many white officers as he could, officials said Friday. And the paper of record noted that many believed anti-police protests would eventually lead to violent attacks on police officers. It was the kind of retaliatory violence that people have feared through 2 years of protests around the country against deaths in police custody. Then there are the murders carried out in the name of various religions. For at least the last three decades, debates have been raging about what level of responsibility, if any, should be assigned to radical Muslim preachers or Muslim politicians when individuals carry out atrocities and murders in the name of Islam. Now, Glenn Greenwald says liberals insist, correctly in his view, that it's irresponsible and unfair to blame nonviolent Muslims who preach radical versions of religious or political Islam for those who carry out violence in the name of those doctrines. Similar debates are heard with regard to Jewish extremists, such as the Israeli-American doctor Baruch Goldstein, who opened fire in the Cave of the Patriarchs in Hebron, killing 29 Muslim worshippers. Many insist that the radical anti-Muslim speech of Israeli extremists is to blame, while others deny that there's any such thing as Jewish terrorism and that all blame lies solely with the individual who decides to resort to violence. Now, Greenwald says, to be sure, there have been a large number of murders and other atrocities carried out in the U.S. and the West, generally in the name of right-wing ideologies, although in the name of white supremacy or in the name of white nationalism. But the difference is glaring. When murders are carried out in the name of liberal ideology, there is a rational, restrained refusal to blame liberal pundits and politicians who advocate the ideology that animated those killings. But when killings are carried out in the name of right-wing ideologies despised by the corporate press or mainstream pundits or ideologies that they falsely associate with conservatism, they instantly leap to lay blame at the feet of their conservative political opponents who, despite never having advocated or ever even implied the need for violence, are nonetheless accused of bearing guilt for the violence, often before anything's known about the killer or their motives. So in general, it's widely understood that liberal pundits and politicians are not to blame at all when murders are carried out in the name of the causes they support or against the enemies they routinely condemn. That's because in such cases, we apply the rational framework that someone who does not advocate violence is not responsible for the violent acts of one's followers and fans who kill in the name of that person's ideas. Seems to make sense. But when a revolting murder spree is carried out in the name of some right-wing idea or ideas perceived by the corporate press to be right-wing, everything changes instantly and completely. And here he goes into the case of 18-year-old Peyton Gendron, who, by the way, I downloaded because I didn't want it to disappear from the internet. It's been scrubbed in many places. His 180-page manifesto, very, very disturbing, but he very clearly says in there, he spent much of his early teen years flirting with communism and, in fact, describes himself as somewhat of a left-of-center moderate. But again, you're supposed to believe this guy is, no, he's just a right-winger, he's a Republican, he's probably some hardcore libertarian. He's not. Left-wing authoritarian is how he would describe himself. Populist. All I'm saying is be very skeptical. Something like this is meant to get you reacting without thinking. This is why politicians love to wave the bloody shirt. Look at this. Look at the people he killed, the innocents, the suffering. And then to turn around and say, this is all because of the political right. This is why we need to take guns away from conservatives in this country. Now, I don't know if this is going to be what they're going to use for leverage, you know, to try to push through some kind of federal gun control thing. But I know the midterms are coming fast. Democrats rightly need to be concerned because it looks like a lot of the country has been very fed up with the authoritarian way in which they have been, how can I say this, inflicting themselves on the country. So if you got to tighten up control, I guess that's probably going to be about as good a way to do it as any. We'll just piggyback on this atrocity, blame it on our political opponents, and then use that to justify, you know, ramping up the war on domestic extremism and terrorism and ultra-MAGA behavior, none of which had anything whatsoever to do with this disturbed individual who shot up a grocery store in Buffalo, New York on Saturday. You got to check out Glenn Greenwald's article. It's linked in my show notes at thebrianhydeshow.com.
This is The Brian Hyde Show. This is The Brian Hyde Show.
All right, welcome back to the show. So I got to warn you, I'm going to make you a little bit uncomfortable, or at least I'm going to make a lot of people uncomfortable. Maybe you'll be one of them, maybe you won't. But with all the attention focused on the November midterms, I guarantee what I'm about to share with you is going to cause some people a little bit of discomfort. I hope I'm saying this author's name right, Elise Reclus. This is an argument about how voting actually sets you up and trains you to part with your freedom. And I guess in full disclosure, I should point out, I have very little faith in voting. And it's not because necessarily, look, I think there's some very serious questions about the election of 2020. I think there have been some pretty serious questions about the whole voting system, though, from long before that. Not so much from the idea that, well, you know, it's all being manipulated and the Dominion voting machines are doing this or doing that. But more from the standpoint of, it seems like we're always presented with false choices, binary choices. You can have this flavor of evil or you can have that flavor of evil. But you're always being given a choice that will only allow you to choose some degree of evil, meaning one of the two major parties, which I think are different sides of the same coin. And that's why I'm much of the opinion that voting does not change things. The only place where I would possibly make an exception for that is at the local, perhaps even the municipal level, maybe the county level. You elect a good sheriff, you're probably in much better stead than, you know, putting all your time and effort into let's get this senator elected or reelected at the federal level or whatever the case may be. President, same kind of thing. Most of the time, it just doesn't matter. But this is an article titled Why Anarchists Don't Vote. And you may not consider yourself an anarchist, which is fine. It's a scary word to some people. They think, oh, that's just, you know, the law of the jungle. It's chaos. It's not. And I say that as someone who leans anarchist. I wouldn't say I'm a full-blown anarchist, but I'm leaning there from the understanding that anarchy, if you break the word down, simply means without ruler. Meaning you don't need some outside ruler dictating, you there, jump this high. You there, put your hands on your head, whatever. I think that we can have rules. I believe that we can rule ourselves. But we don't need some central leader telling us every step what we need to be doing. So with that in mind, hopefully taking some of the sting out of the word anarchy, here's what Elise Reclus says. Everything that can be said about suffrage can be summed up in a sentence. To vote is to give up your own power. To elect a master or many for a long time or a short time is to resign one's liberty. Call it an absolute monarch, a constitutional king, or a simple member of parliament, the candidate that you raise to the throne, to the seat, or to the easy chair, he will always be your master. They are persons that you put above the law, since they have the power of making the laws and because it is their mission to see that they are obeyed. So to vote is befitting of idiots. It is as foolish as believing that men of the same make as ourselves will acquire in a moment, at the ringing of a bell, the knowledge and understanding of everything. Of course it is so. your elected person shall have to legislate on every subject under the moon, how a box of matches should or should not be made, or how to make war, how to improve the agriculture, how to best kill a tribe of Arabs or a few Negroes. Probably you believe their intelligence will grow in proportion to the variety of subjects they have to give their minds to. But history and experience teaches otherwise. The possession of power has a maddening influence. Parliaments have always sought, or always wrought, rather, unhappiness. In the ruling assemblies, in a fatal manner, the will prevails of those below the average, both morally and intellectually. And so Elsie Reclus says, to vote is to prepare shameful treachery and traitors. Electors certainly do believe in the honesty of the candidates, and this is to a certain extent existing while the fervor and the heat of the contest remains. But every day has its tomorrow, and as soon as the conditions alter, likewise do men change. Today, your candidate bows humbly before your presence. Tomorrow, he will say pish to you. From a cadger of votes, he has turned to be a master of yours. How can a worker enrolled by you amongst the ruling class be the same as before, since now he can speak in terms of equality with other oppressors? Look at the servility of any one of them written all over his face, after paying a call to a captain of industry or when the king invites him to the antechamber of his court. The atmosphere of the house is not for deep breathing. It is corrupt. If you send one of yourselves in a foul place, you must not be surprised afterward if he comes back in a rotten condition. Therefore, do not part with your freedom. Don't vote. Instead of entrusting the defense of your interests to others, see to the matter by yourselves. Instead of trying to choose advisors that will guide you in future actions, do the thing yourselves and do it now. Men of goodwill shall not have to look long in vain for the opportunity. To put on others' shoulders the responsibility of one's actions is cowardice. Don't vote. Now, I understand that's not going to resonate with everybody. And I'm not expecting you to, you know, say, okay, well, then I guess I just won't vote. But it does put a little bit different perspective on the idea of what is voting actually accomplishing. I think most of us were trained to view this as kind of that's the high sacrament of our civic religion. And yet, if it really changed anything, you'd have to reconcile some of the questions that arise when it comes time to cast your vote. Why is it that the system, the two-party system particularly, always seems to offer us a choice of people who will largely keep the system just as it is? In other words, will protect the status quo. But anyone who offers a meaningful change, or at least a pause in the headlong rush towards, you know, deeper and stronger statism, is considered, well, that's an unelectable person, or that's somebody we can't even take seriously. I know, my longtime listeners are like, Brian, you have railed on this for years, and I continue to do so. But it's because I now have years of experience to look back on and say, this seems to bear out. The pattern appears to be a true pattern. Every time we hold our noses, every time we compromise our values for the sake of, well, I know it sucks, but I got to vote for Mitt Romney because he's better than, you know, this person. All it does is provide another stronger toehold for the institutionalized corruption that defines politics today. So, you know, I'm not saying you have to be at this point, but I have reached the point where I have absolutely no faith in politics or political solutions for most of the problems that we're facing, mainly because most of the problems we're facing, at least in my opinion, were created by politicians or created by special interests. They're political problems at their root. So I'm much more inclined to say, yeah, people who withhold their vote, people who say, I'm not going to vote because it gives legitimacy and status to a system that no longer represents me. You know, we've all heard the saying, well, if you didn't vote, you don't have any room to complain. And I agree with George Carlin. Screw that. If you vote, you don't have room to complain because you are the one who actually validated the system that is busy putting you underneath its boot. So what do we do, right? Give us a solution, Brian. Don't just complain about it. Well, I can't give you a solution that is, you know, the one true solution that only, you know, we should all be following, just this one and this one alone. But I do believe there is great value in knowing yourself well enough that you know when it is okay to withdraw your consent. And for some people, withdrawing that consent is going to look a lot like, I'm not going to participate in a system that at every turn is trying to steal from me in the form of taxes, or trying to oppress me in the form of laying laws upon laws and regulations upon regulations on my back and trying to insist I believe it's for my own good. I don't buy that. And I don't think you should either. And if people say, well, you can't escape politics, to a degree that is true, but you can certainly minimize its influence in your life. I mean, come on. How many people do you know who, when some, you know, high-ranking politician, be it a federal senator or be it a governor or someone, comes around, they get all goo-goo eyes? They want to post selfies on social media. Look at me. Look, I'm standing in the presence of someone who's famous and has authority. And, you know, they don't understand. It's just as crass. It's just as silly and giggly as a bunch of teenage girls fawning over a pop music star. Worse, though, it gives that politician this unearned sense of status that tends to reinforce, no, you really are someone who walks on water. You are someone who lives a more rarefied existence than the rest of us. Which sadly just encourages them to keep doing what they're doing, or to support the system that is doing us all dirty right now. So again, you don't have to take the hard line that I have chosen to take. But maybe it's time to consider whether that vote is really doing the good you think it's doing.
This is the Brian Hyde Show. This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Hey, welcome back to the show. I want to give a shout out here to Dr. Ward Wagner at Dixie Chiropractic. You can go to their website at dixiechiro.com. I am so happy to have them as a sponsor of the program, and happy to tell you they are there to help you or a loved one no matter what kind of pain you are dealing with. Let me give you a couple of examples. Neuropathy. You dealing with that? How about the $99 Calmare treatment plus massage? Go to dixiechiro.com for more information. Bulging herniated discs? Boy, that'll put a hitch in your get along. Look at this, though. $99 intro special, two treatments plus massage. Just get in touch with dixiechiro.com to get your appointment set up. And of course, if you have someone dealing with car accident injuries, again, Dixie Chiropractic, Dr. Ward Wagner, just visit their website, dixiechiro.com. And when you set up your appointment, please tell them thank you for sponsoring this show. Okay, two articles left here in the last segment here. By the way, I know I was on a bit of a rant in that last one about, voting training us to part with our freedom. And maybe it's just my personal distaste and kind of disgust with politicians in general. I'm much more of the attitude that, you know what, you are better off solving as many of your problems as you can at the most personal level possible. Don't try to outsource stuff. Don't go seeking political solutions unless you want them to be entrenched as a part of your life, you know, from this date forward. With that said, let's move on here. Political debate requires a degree of give and take, and what we're seeing today doesn't really have that feel. It's more of a scorched earth approach. Brandon Smith has an excellent article titled "Leftists Hate Free Speech Because They Fear Dissent, Not Disinformation." I want to just share a couple of quick points with you. He says, I think one of the most bizarre social developments of the past 10 years in the U.S. has been the slow but steady shift of the political left as supposed defenders of free speech to enemies of free speech. And he says the level of mental gymnastics on display by leftists to justify their attacks on freedom and on the First Amendment is bewildering. So much so that he says, I begin to question if liberals and leftists ever actually had any respect for First Amendment rights to begin with. Or maybe the only freedom they cared about all along was the freedom to watch pornography. One can see the steady progression of this war on speech and ideas, and the end game is predictable. Is anyone really that surprised that the Biden administration is implementing a Ministry of Truth in the form of the DHS Disinformation Governance Board? He says, can we just accept the reality at this point that leftists are evil and their efforts feed into an agenda of authoritarianism? Is there any evidence to the contrary? Now, Brandon Smith says, before I get into this issue, I think it's important to point out that it's becoming tiresome to hear arguments these days suggesting that meeting leftists somewhere in the middle is the best and most desirable option. He says, I see this attitude all over the place, and I think it comes from a certain naivety about the situation that we're facing as a country. Moderates and normies, along with people like Bill Maher and Russell Brand, are finally starting to realize how bag lady crazy leftists are, and the pendulum is swinging back slightly. But it was conservatives that were calling out the social justice cult and their highway to hell for years. While everyone else was blissfully ignorant, we were fighting the battles that stalled the leftist advance. Now, this is not to say I'm not happy to have moderates and reformed liberals on board. That's a great thing. However, the time for diplomacy and meeting leftists halfway, he says, is long dead. There is no such thing as a center in our society anymore. Either you lean conservative and you support freedom, or you lean left and you support authoritarianism. There's no magical and utopian in-between that we need to achieve to make things right. We're not required to tolerate leftist authoritarianism because democracy. Sometimes certain ideologies and certain groups are mutually exclusive to freedom, meaning they cannot coexist within a society that values liberty. We need to be clear about where the lines are drawn, because sitting on the fence is not an option. Walk in the middle of the road and get squished like a grape. So to understand how the leftists got to the point of enthusiastic hatred of free speech rights, he says there are some psychological and philosophical factors that need to be addressed, and these include specific ideals that leftists value that are disjointed or simply irrational. So he goes into some great detail here on how hate speech is real and must be censored. This is one of the things that leftists will often say. And Brandon Smith says, look, there is no such thing as hate speech. There's speech that some people don't like and speech that they're offended by, but that's it. Constitutionally, there is no hate speech. People are allowed to say any offensive thing they wish and believe however they wish, as long as they're not slandering a person's reputation with lies or threatening them with direct bodily harm. Now, if you're offended by criticism, that is your problem. Leftists believe the opposite. Instead of growing a thicker skin, they think hate speech should be illegal. And they think that they should be the people who should determine what that hate speech is. Now, that's a magical door to power, because if you can declare yourself the arbiter of hate speech, then you give yourself the authority to control all speech. That is to say, as the thought police, all you have to do is label everything you don't like as hate speech, no matter how factual, and now you dictate the course of society. His point is nobody has this kind of objectivity or benevolence. No person alive has the ability to determine what speech is acceptable without bias. Like the One Ring and the Lord of the Rings, there is no individual or group capable of wielding such power without being corrupted by it. Either there is no hate speech or everything becomes hate speech. He talks about the idea that free speech is negated by property rights. This is direct reference to social media websites and an oversimplification of the issue of free speech and large social media platforms. And he goes into the false paradigm and explains it very, very well. He talks about disinformation being a threat and how censorship is being proffered as the solution. And he goes into great detail here. Now, I'm gonna cut this short because I want you to check it out for yourself. There is a link in my show notes, which you can access at thebrianhydeshow.com. But here's the bottom line. He says, leftists operate from a collectivist mentality, and this makes them believe that society is a singular entity that needs to be managed and manipulated in order to achieve a desired outcome. They have no concept of individual responsibility and discernment. But that's a side note to the real problem. They support information control because facts and ideas outside of their narrative could possibly damage that narrative. And if the narrative is damaged, they lose their feeling of power, which is all they really care about. Now, he says, if your narrative is so fragile that it doesn't hold up to scrutiny or alternative viewpoints, then it must not be worth much. If you have to force people or manipulate people into believing the way you do, then your ideology must be fundamentally flawed. The truth speaks volumes for itself and eventually wins without force. Only lies need to be forced into the collective consciousness. Only lies require tyranny. But he says eventually reality wins over propaganda unless total censorship and totalitarianism can be achieved. Nothing has changed in the 200 plus years since the creation of the Bill of Rights. Free speech is still integral to a functioning society. Without it, society crumbles. Now, they will claim today things are different. Society needs to be protected from itself. But that's what tyrants always say when they're trying to steal power. Brandon Smith says most people reading this know by now this is a war. It's not a political debate that requires give or take. It's just a full-bore winner-take-all conflict. And he says a Department of Homeland Security faction, which is mandated to monitor our speech and propagandize the public, is unacceptable and must be eliminated. Leftist and globalist monopoly of social media communications platforms is unacceptable, and it must be eliminated. The imposition of leftist and globalist ideology into the media narrative while censoring any contrary information is unacceptable and must be eliminated. This is about saving the remaining embers of American culture. If we do not take an aggressive stand now, the next generation may never know liberty. Everything we hold dear is at stake. I'd say he's right. I'd say he's right. And it's not, you know, let's go fight him in the streets. Come on, join me, Proud Boys. Let's go fight Antifa. Let's take it to a little more adult level than bare-knuckle brawls in the streets. This just means you've got to be very clear on who you are, what you stand for, and be able to persuasively share that with other people and be willing to speak up when people are saying you can't say that, you can't believe that, you can't think that. Defy them. Do it anyway, but do it lovingly. Some people may think that's contradictory, but I'm telling you, it can be done. One final note here. I'm including in the show notes today a link to Jim Quinn's latest published on lewrockwell.com. We talked about fourth turning methodology before. Great champions who are kind of the leaders that emerge. Abraham Lincoln was one. Winston Churchill was one. Ben Franklin and so forth. Would you believe there is a possibility that Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping may actually be gray champions of this fourth turning? Jim Quinn goes into detail. See, the key here is to be a gray champion doesn't mean that you're necessarily a good person or adored by everybody. But simply that you have the leadership skills to shepherd a people or a culture or a nation through very, very difficult times. I think you'll find it a fascinating read. Check it out in the show notes.
This is The Brian Hyde Show.